Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. We're in the middle of August 2017. One of the hardest lessons, one of the most difficult lessons that I've ever learned, and one that I haven't fully wrapped my brain around yet, is the fact that the overwhelming majority of humanity, or at least the overwhelming majority of Americans, don't care whether their beliefs are true or false, and in fact may reject those categories altogether. You're a professional historian or scientist of some kind, and you know all you care about is fact. You're taught in very, very strict research methods how to make an argument, all the fallacies, ways to avoid them, citing sources, using evidence, using data, finding patterns, only to learn that most people don't give a damn if what you're saying is true or false. They're primarily concerned with their own self-interest. They want to be told what they want to hear. That their lifestyle, or whatever it might be, is okay. That everyone's doing whatever it is. Problem is, you have somebody with a long-standing delusion. Now, I've dealt with this my whole life. I just had a lengthy debate online with someone over the Holocaust. And they have never heard the anti-Nuremberg point of view put forth before. They had never heard, they only knew of it in caricature form. And when they heard me put it in academic terms, as a historian, they flipped out. Now, in my experience, the flip out comes in a bunch of different ways. Sometimes it's violent. Sometimes it's personal insults. Sometimes it's changing the subject very rapidly. Sometimes it's accusing you of things that you're obviously not showing, that you're desperate or you're scared, you're winning the argument, and they're telling you how they feel to be losing the argument. It's very, very dangerous to do this, and you can only approach it with caution. It is much easier to argue with somebody who's already your friend. The way I got through grad school is that I made friends before I ever talked about politics. They knew I was a nice guy and a good guy, and he's got to get along with. And then I could talk about more controversial stuff, and they could agree or disagree. But they never thought I should be, you know, gassed or anything, because I knew I was a decent guy. Yeah, that's Matt. He's just a nut. You know, that's the ideal situation. Now, in The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, in Kuhn's book, it's not immediate. You know, a paradigm of scientific thought, given time, doesn't immediately collapse upon hearing or dealing with contradictory evidence. It takes a long time. It takes a long time, the foundations, the edifice itself, respectability, the money, of course, which he refuses to deal with in that book, these all have to slowly be shot through with holes. And then larger and larger schools outside of the main one begin to build and then become mainstream themselves. That's the basic model. Now, for those who can be reached, not every human being, this is a separate issue though. Not everything on two legs is a human being. A human being is someone who can freely use their rational capacity to think objectively about the world. That's what makes a human being a human being. If someone can't do this, they're not human. Unfortunately, that removes a whole lot of people from the human category. This is what Aristotle called slaves. He didn't necessarily mean it in a chattel slave sense, but he just meant that these people could be nothing but followers. They could be nothing but lowly, because they simply can't think for themselves. You know what honesty is. Honesty is permanent exile. No one wants to know the truth. I can honestly say that I've never told a lie as an adult, and it's led me to nothing but problems and trouble and heartache. It's a terrible policy. I follow it anyway, but it's nothing but a problem. The wife comes down and says, "Do I look fat in this?" You say, "Yeah." It's a problem. I was told that it's my best and my worst quality at the same time. So a human being is someone with free will, and free will implies the rational faculty. The question you have to ask always is, free will to do what? And on what grounds? Can't be just anything. That means the overwhelming majority of people, especially today, aren't really human. They're a lower form of animal that walks on two legs. And that brings up an entire conversation about their soul. Because there is nothing in scripture or tradition that says everything on two legs is a human being and therefore has an immortal soul. The fact that they might look like us in no way suggests that they're human. There are plenty of times where you're fooled and one thing looks like another. What's taken post-modernity and made it so radically different from every other time in history, very unique from any other time in cosmic history, is the fact that most people truly believe, however, that they are free, educated, and rational people, and that they will mock others for being unenlightened. That brings up a second secondary topic. I came across somebody online the other day claiming to be a goddess who was all-knowing. I initially thought she was just kidding around. She wasn't. So my mind starts to how do I deal with this? I tried to be as kind as I knew there was something wrong here. I knew she was serious. I knew she thought this. So I asked her. I said, "Tell me the difference in Aristotle's metaphysics between a form and a universal." And she said, "Well, I know everything that's worth knowing." She was very upset. Again, the bubble had been burst. You're going to come across a lot of nuts, you know, in any kind of extreme, non-mainstream movement. There are people like me who join it out of conviction. There are people who see it as just a way for someone who's already marginal to have some moral focus for their marginality. I treated her with the utmost kindness. Ultimately, I ended it by saying, you know, at the very least, don't tell people this. Don't just go up to people and say this, because they will put you away. They will at least mock you and worse. We all know people who have delusions where they are autistic in a very severe way. They need to be treated with the utmost kindness. They're never to be rejected. They're never to be treated with contempt. It's not their fault. And you will answer for that. You treat them like a normal person, and if possible, if you get them alone, explain that, and don't even say, you know, your behavior is okay by me, but it isn't by others. Please understand. I want to protect you. I'm your friend here. Anyway, with this woman, it was, when I told her I made the mistake of trying to pathologize her, I said, "Well, you must have been through one hell of a trauma. People don't start talking like that and mean it unless there's been a severe trauma." She's radically dissociated. And my heart went out to her the whole time. She was insulting me and everything, you know. We're all idiots compared to her. And I just, I felt more and more pity for her. But showing pity is not a good idea. So I settled on the strategy of simply saying that, yes, you know, yes, you know a lot, but please don't talk like that in general, because they will do terrible things to you. Which they already had, according to her. It's come up recently. My son had posted something on Facebook about mental illness, not just in politics, but in general. We know that in the latter part of the Soviet era, especially the Khrushchev era, opponents of the regime were called insane, because there is no way you could possibly oppose the workers' paradise, the end of history. Well, remember, too, liberal capitalism also claimed it's the end of history. So you have a similar situation. You can't possibly oppose that. There's something wrong with you. I have a paper coming out on Grigorenko, major general of the Soviet Army, who rejected the Soviet Union in the 60s and 70s, and was treated the same when he was put in the mental institution. And it was claimed that a man like this, a war hero from World War II, who could have everything, not too far from retirement, is not going to deliberately throw it all away unless there's something wrong with him mentally. They never even thought of the idea that maybe he's right. That was off the radar. So we have to be very careful when we call people nuts or spurge or whatever the term is. Be careful with that. The Soviets used that to stigmatize their opponents, put them in institutions, and pump them full of all kinds of experimental drugs. Remember that when you call names. Calling names is a bad idea. It's a sign of weakness. It's a sign of weakness. It's done only in extreme desperation when you're trying to get someone to, when you're trying to shock someone into coherence. But we're dealing with people like this all the time. None of us really innocent of eccentricity. We're talking about real pathologs. And for those people, you treat them like a normal human being, but you have to do something. You have to get them alone and explain their behavior is improper and that something bad may happen to them if they continue. And then become their friend and work with them. And this is your responsibility as a human being, as a member of the movement, or if it's an Orthodox setting, you know, it's your responsibility as a member of the church to do that. Love just recently was defined to me as self-giving, is wishing the best for somebody, working for the best for someone else, without any regard to your own condition. That's the definition of love. Now, if that's true, there are very, very few human beings that could ever experience love. It is not a romantic emotion. It is not some sexual drive. It certainly doesn't mean indulgence. You love somebody, therefore you let them do whatever they want. If love is working for the ultimate good for somebody, then silencing them may in fact be what's good for them. The key ingredient is not really caring what happens to you. We live in an age of suffering right now. The regime has gone wild. The regime is in serious trouble. It's lashing out all over the place. It will not be legal. It won't be normal. It won't be predictable. The state, whether you're talking at any level, it's just like somebody who has a delusion that you are in the process of destroying, and destroying with good evidence. Something that they can't just dismiss immediately. The key ingredient is simply not caring what happens. Therefore, suffering is probably going to result. This is an age where demons have totally been unleashed on society. It sounds like, smells like the end time. I mean, I'm always loath to say that. Because it's been brought in such disrepute by these Protestant sectarians, every 5 minutes are talking about the end times, and now they've made a mockery of that subject. Now, the Orthodox Church has very rarely, if ever, spoken about the end times until now. There was a brief period of time, it's actually our topic for today, a brief period of time during the reign of St. Gennadius of Novgorod. In the Muscovite period of Russian history, there was some thinking that, you know, 1492 was the year. And, of course, the Old Believers lived in constant expectation. But other than that, you don't see apocalyptic theories proliferating all over the place. Often, if you see them, they're local rather than global. To rationally view our world and its own obsession with its own end, you can't flip the channels on TV without seeing a reference to zombies or the end or something like that. That's never happened before. It's almost an obsession. It's almost a radical preoccupation. But you have the possibility of global rule. You have the gospel preached in all languages, everywhere, with no exceptions. There's an Orthodox Church in North Korea, in Pyongyang, Saints Peter and Paul. There's no place where the Orthodox Church does not exist. And certainly, by the nature of warfare, the nature of demonic rule. I say this, you know, demons, just like bankers, always have to hide. They can never really rule openly. They always have to have some scam, some institution they could hide behind, some universalistic claim that they could pretend is actually theirs. Today, and I learned this from Mike Hoffman, thank God for him, a revelation of the method, meaning that elites who secretly held power, for example, like the Medicis in Florence, who were hidden through most of that period, now could come out and rule openly. When the American banking establishment was almost destroyed in 2007, federal government, completely dependent on those very same banks for credit, forced the American taxpayers to bail them out. Nothing happened. Now, I said this before, and I'll say it again, I can't believe it. Nothing happened. It was screwed by bankers in numerous ways, and now we're forced to bail them out without any ownership, public ownership in the banks. And they used that money to float more loans. Maybe more conservative this time, they used it to float more loans. They're back on track today, but they exist only because of subsidies. This is the nature of capitalism. Point I'm trying to make is, when no rebellion occurred, when no mass movement developed, when the taxpayers were forced to bail out at almost $1 trillion, these elite banks, I said, well, I guess we're here. The term is abulia, another term I learned from Michael Hoffman, a Greek term that refers to lethargy, but a lethargy because there's no point in action. It's complicated. It's almost an iconic word. It means that you don't want to act because there's no point in acting. It's not just because you're lazy. It's because there is no truth or falsehood, there is no good or evil, so what is the point of working? The zombification of human beings seemed to be complete until the Trump campaign. Now, Donald Trump is not, he has no political ideology at all. I'm going to say about Donald Trump, I was a little kid when he first hit it big in Manhattan. I was just in New Jersey, right across the river. The man has no political knowledge. He's not a political person. He's not knowledgeable at all in foreign affairs or domestic affairs. He knows business. He knows inner city, New York especially, New York, New Jersey real estate. And otherwise, he doesn't know anything. But for whatever reason, he saw that there was a huge part of the market that was being untapped. That is, people like me who were socially conservative but economically radical wondered why that hadn't been tapped before and sought to fill that gap. It was simply a market calculation, and a very good one. As president, of course, as we all know, you know, the president's not a dictator. The president can't pass laws. The president can only do what Congress tells him to do. He can interpret to a very slight extent congressional law, and of course he's also subject to the Supreme Court. The president can't have an agenda. And I started laughing when people started talking about Trump like he can't have an agenda. He's not being elected to pass laws. Now, what you think about executive orders, which are kind of a new thing, been used a lot recently, they also could be struck down by the courts if necessary. But by and large, the president is not cannot pass laws. He is not really meant to be a knowledgeable political figure. He is a policeman. Essentially, his job is to be the organizer of his cabinet, that is to say, the organizer of the executive branch, or that which is to implement the laws that Congress has passed and put into action. So he most certainly is not, he doesn't have really an agenda at all. But he was painted by the left in hysterical terms as a nationalist. And they went into action. Corporate America, finance, group after group after group, since they are so heavily dependent on foreign labor, to try to shut him down. They're rioting at, you know, as I said many times, and I'll say many times in the future, if this happened in a third world country, the U.S. would condemn the election as fraudulent. And yet he won anyway. Therefore, lots of people refused to be zombies in this particular case and went and voted for him anyway. Now, I've read polls in Russian and Ukrainian and other languages that showed Hillary Clinton getting no more than 10%. Anything more than 10 or 15% for her is fraud. Her rallies were empty. She did very little campaigning. She was very, very sick. And she did things on the campaign trail that almost looked demonic. That little flip out she did in front of the cameras with her mouth wide open, I thought that was really extremely bizarre. It looked like she was having an aneurysm. There's been claims of a body double that have been, lots of politicians have body doubles. Margaret Thatcher had one, Saddam Hussein had one. That could fill in when she's too sick to function. But she had very little support in the Democratic Party, let alone amongst the Americans in general, who, you know, those guys were very excited over Bernie, a man who I disagree with in a lot of things, but at least I respect the guy. With Hillary Clinton, because of her record, we know you can't respect her at all. She's simply a scam artist, as is her husband. So she probably in general got about 10% of the votes. If you remember the last few weeks up to the election, all the major presses, without exception, except the Washington Times, said that Trump is definitely going to win, no point in going to the polls. Trump is going to win. In fact, Hillary isn't even thinking about him anymore. They knew this wasn't true, but this was the manipulation of the election. The election was illegal and manipulated in so many different ways, it would take way too long to go through. Anyway, what's the point of all this? The point of all this is that when you come to realize that everything that the average American believes about the world is wrong, and yet that same American thinks that they are the apogee of Western history, that they cannot be fooled, that they are educated, that they are free, that they are rational, they become very dangerous people to deal with. And I'm seeing this getting worse and worse and worse. The pattern seems to be right now that, say, a topic like Srebrenica or the Holocaust, something like that, I will throw out a lot of evidence in my favor, explaining why the establishment position is incorrect, and which they will ignore. They will then talk about something often peripheral, and then lash out in one of the ways I've already stated that they do. It's very important, and I ask my listeners to study the list of fallacies, both formal and informal, because most of what they'll say in the lash out phase is fallacious. They don't understand logic, and they really don't care. People don't realize how hard it is to actually build a logical argument, a rational argument using evidence. That's very, very hard, because fallacies are very easy to fall into. You have to find something that covers as much of the data as possible. You know, ideally with nothing left over. And if it's something you don't want, well, too bad. You have to suck it up. We're in a situation now of great danger and of great suffering. Now, before we continue, I want to take a minute here. We're losing so many good people. I mean, I know Ernst Lindell died, but a friend of mine, Julie Foster, has passed away of cancer. Julie Foster may be totally unknown to most of you. She was the circulation director and manager at the Spotlight, American Free Press, and Barnes Review for almost 30 years. She was my friend. When I first got hired in 99, she showed me around the place. She was always very, very sweet. She had no ego. She kept the place running, and yet no one even knows who she is. And I wrote a brief obituary for her, and I said, this is the kind of labor that wins wars. Not people like me who need the attention and to be on the radio and have people say how smart you are. No, this, the labor, the labor that no one sees, the thankless jobs, the hard work no one ever thanks you for, that no one even realizes occurs. And yet she did it for that long. Willis Cardo depended on her to a tremendous extent. And that means that the nationalist movement in America depended on her to a great extent. So she is an experienced worker in this area, and she has died. She was only 64. And a friend of mine, and we can't afford to lose any more people. We're losing a lot of people, and there aren't a whole lot of people to replace them. In some ways, some of the people that we're building, the situation that we have now is better, but only because the situation is more dire. You know, white males can't give loyalty to the system anymore. The system has long since rejected them and says that they're not necessary. They'll be replaced, whether it be by women or by immigrants or by machines or something else. And yet, the entire edifice, good, bad, and indifferent of Western civilization, was created by white males. White males who did the hard labor in the mines and in the fields, on the battlefields, while women were quite safe at home. And so the rallies that we've been putting on recently have been, we will not be replaced. And that's been the slogan. And it's very important to me. Unfortunately, people like Julia are not being replaced. I don't have the virtue that she had. I couldn't work in the background and have no one know what I'm doing for almost 30 years. So I'm taking time out to inform my audience what a great woman she was, and that she was my friend, and that she kept the Spotlight, AFP, the Barnes Review, the book club, the book publishing organization, the Foundation for Economic Liberty, all that stuff afloat and functional for 25 years at least. Think of the hospital. She was a nurse. Yeah, we're all doctors. You know, I'm a doctor. We're the scholars, all this kind. But nurses really keep the place going. Nurses are the ones that patients deal with far more importantly than doctors. They hardly ever see doctors in a hospital, but nurses they see all the time. They're the ones that keep the system going. They're the reason that a hospital could even function for more than 30 consecutive seconds. And I view Julie in the very same way. So, 30 minutes in, I want to talk about something that I've written about before but hasn't been spoken of to a great extent. and that is Judaism in medieval Novgorod. I have a paper out, really, it's only on my website. It may be elsewhere. If it is, I don't know about it. The title is Judaism in Medieval Novgorod, the Development of the Russian Orthodox Church's Doctrine on the Jew. The significance here is that the Orthodox Church has long since legislated on the Jewish question. Johnson's Law being what it is, it's safe to be ignored. Now, some will say that these are only local synods, therefore we can ignore them. No, they're still true. It doesn't matter if one person is affirming them. What difference does it make whether it's local or not? It's true. In the late 15th century, a small group of revolutionary Jews sought to take Western Russia. This became known as the Judaizer heresy. They approached Russia from the northwest, from the oligarchy of Novgorod, and sought to move it away from Moscow. It was already a part of the Hanseatic League, the largest city in the Hanseatic League, and this small Jewish elite had various weapons to try to divide Western Russia from Moscow. And two people, St. Joseph of Volokh and Gennady, the Metropolitan of Novgorod, then were involved in not only writings, which are patristic writings, and synodal decisions, council decisions, that once and for all dealt with the question on the Jewish area. Now, mainstream English publications, you will get no good information. The average American professor writing books on this topic doesn't know what the Kabbalah is, doesn't know what the Talmud is, doesn't know the Jewish mentality, and even if they did, they certainly wouldn't publish about it. One of the most important things to understand about medieval Russia was that Novgorod was an oligarchy. It was the Russian version of Venice. It was very wealthy. Yet they spoke Russian. They were firmly Orthodox, at least the common people were. And so Moscow wanted to bring it closer to it, and it was absolutely necessary. Novgorod was dependent on trade, even though agriculture was very important, but it was surrounded by swamps. Bad girl at the time was Martha Beretsky, a slave owner in Novgorod, one of the most powerful women in Eastern Europe, led the anti-Moscow party and wanted to create some kind of a loose confederation with Poland. The leader of the Judaizing party that came into Novgorod was Sharia Zhidovnov. Probably a Kabbalist and clearly involved in alchemy and these kind of sciences that came out of the Italian Renaissance. They're older than that, but that's how they, you know, found their way into Europe. He appeared in Novgorod in 1471. It's not an accident. This is the final phase of the reconquest in Spain. And so there's this mass exodus of Jews from the area. There was also anti-Jewish laws in Lithuania. And so there was a search for a new base. He came with the entourage of Prince Michael, Balakievich of Kiev, who thought to use them and use Novgorod to finance his own organization. Jews were brought into Poland by the oligarchy for one reason. Because they had no loyalty to the monarchy or the church, and therefore those institutions could not use urban trade for their own benefit, as they had done in England. Others were involved, Moses Hansich, Joseph Shmolov, and their strategy is something that we might find very, very familiar. They directed their efforts at the high elites. And historians are terrified of being called anti-Semitic, so they won't say very much. They say dumb things like, they were opposed to church corruption. They were opposed to icons. Like, this was the issue. They created cellular structures of 5 men each and went after the church first and foremost. There was no attempt to go to the lower classes whatsoever. And the first two priests that they, probably through sexual indiscretion, but I don't know this for a fact, it's been hinted in the past, the priests Denis and Alexei. Alexei was renamed Abraham and his wife became Sarah. And that was supposed to be the beginning of this revolution, Judaic revolution in medieval Russia. This is extremely important if we're talking about the end times, if we're talking about the situation in our world, why we suffer the way we do, and why Russia is the way it is. Immediately, St. Gennady, who was a metropolitan of Novgorod at the time, knew this. He received word that there was an organized attempt of European Jews to take Novgorod, and ultimately Moscow. So in 1488, a synod was called, and it officially condemned all forms of Kabbalah, alchemy, and Zionism. And St. Joseph of Valok actually wrote his Illuminator partly as a part of this synodal condemnation. In other words, Jewish nationalism and its use of subterfuge to take over areas was condemned by the Orthodox Church and condemned before it could do any real damage. Charles VIII expelled the Jews in 1493. The chief rabbi of Arles, Shamora, saw this policy developing and saw that, you know, resentment is growing. Unrest was growing in urban France against the Jews. And so he went to the Jewish community in Constantinople and he asked for advice in a letter in 1489. The chief rabbi was named Yusuf. And the chief rabbi in Constantinople said this to him, and I'm quoting here. Beloved brother, Moses, we received your complaint outlining the misery and suffering that torment you. They cause us as much grief as they do you. The king is urging you to be baptized, then do it, keeping the sacred law of Moses in your heart. They threaten to take away our property. Remember that our merchants will soon take away all that belongs to the Christians. Do they threaten your life? Soon, our cooks, pharmacists, and doctors will take theirs. They destroy your synagogues? Well, soon we'll own their churches and will destroy the temples of the Goyim. We will do this by ensuring our entry into the professions, such as medicine, law, public service, and soon we will dominate those who presently persecute us. We will be avenged. Be patient, but this method will take us to the summit of power. I translated that myself from the Russian as dated November 21st, 1489. The letter itself was first found in a monastic library in Salamanca in Spain, and now is in the archives of Toledo as part of its Spanish State Antiquities section. Therefore, it's absolutely genuine. There's no question about it. And the Toledo archives, the antiquities division will tell you that it is it's extremely genuine, and it was written on November 1st, 1489. Now, we're not in a situation in America where a phony conversion is necessary. If a Jew converts to Orthodoxy, you treat him with all the respect that you would give anyone else. Obviously, they're finding something wrong with their Jewish life, and you need to encourage that, of course. I have heard people say that, you know, don't deal with him because he's a Jew. He was a Jew at one time. I said, well, wait a minute. He converted. There's no pressure on them to convert, so they wouldn't do it unless they really had reason to. You show them respect. You give them all the encouragement you possibly can. But that letter is evidence of clearly a secret society within Christendom dedicated to destroying it. This was a Jewish revolutionary, and it was from here on that they were obsessed with disguising their identity They change their names, their appearances, religion, outwardly, for the sake of penetrating the host society. The difference today is, as I said early on, is that they are willing to rule openly as Goyim-hating Jews. Now, I went to the University of Hartford, which I think is about 40% Jewish. I have many Jewish friends. Keep in mind something here. We talk about a group as a social force. When we talk about an individual member of that group who lives next door, they're not related. You could say that, you know, Jews have been a cancer in Europe, but have plenty of Jewish friends. Those two things are not in conflict. Only anomalists would say that they're in conflict. No, a group as a social force is completely different than an individual person. They're not related whatsoever. When I was fired from Mount St. Mary's, it was a Jewish music professor, the only one who defended me, Rosenfeld. So I'm not, you know, as individuals, we make no judgment whatsoever. But as far as the historical record is concerned, this is what we're dealing with here. And this should sound very familiar to you. Now, we talk about technology and science. We're talking about the alchemical attempt to create a new man. Astrology and Gnostic alchemy combined, you know, proto-scientific theory with social revolution. They saw these two priests as the vanguard of new Russia. And of course, it's not an accident that all revolutionary groups after this have been very much of this character. Sexual revolution was permitted, and you see how having a harem might be attractive to young priests. Justifying their lusts is a huge lever of power that they happen to have. They were outwardly very humble. And these men who they converted had access to credit, money, and justification. That means that they went the ranks quickly and were close very soon to Ivan III. It spread in Novgorod because it justified slavery. This was music to the ears of the oligarchs. It divided the world between the elite and the cattle. Of course, they didn't tell them that they're part of the cattle, but at least for the time being, they seemed to be in this aristocratic mold. And it promised these men tremendous power through credit, money, technology. Fyodor Kuritsin is a major government official who spoke German, Polish, Hungarian, and Greek. He became the leader of this Judaizer group. By roughly 1500, it had about 1,000 adherents in several Russian cities. Sinkanagis and Ivan III, they saw Sharia as a way to infiltrate Lithuania. His daughter Alina supported the Jews, and his son Dmitry was proclaimed heir. But this, the mysterious power the Judaizers promised and had was irresistible. The Kabbalah was attractive as it provided an avenue to money and power. But the Kabbalists also convinced students that complete initiation in secret science is only possible if they renounce Christ. 14th and 15th centuries, the West were marked by a special enthusiasm for science that ultimately came down to alchemy. The so-called secret books of Aristotle were peddled by the Judaizers to give a Gentile feel to what they were doing. The Neoplatonists had nothing to do with Plato, but they used his name for the sake of justifying their magical arts. Plato, as a philosopher, had nothing to do with magic, never talked about it, never dealt with it. So the Neoplatonists that have been condemned by the church have nothing to do with him. And it's been mentioned to me before, you can't be a Platonist because of that condemnation. I explained to them that the Neoplatonists weren't Platonists at all. It was simply a cover story that these alchemists were using. And they ignored me and they say to the next guy. Plato had no use for this ideology. And even the actual text of real Neoplatonists, like Plotinus, their best known, a man who I know well ideologically, had no such agenda. Dionysius, one of the first converts, was told that he could remain a Christian and still practice these arts. Perfectly okay. They always had these ways around the law. Their conscience had to be reassured. They were told to appear as Christian as possible, to maintain the tradition, so that there became an association in the popular mind between this heresy and Christian piety. Now, the Talmud and the Kabbalah are not opposed to one another. They're two sides of the same coin. It's a direct reaction to Christ. It denied and it replaced the Old Testament and declared not just Christ and Mary to be in hell, but the prophets as well, because they condemned Israel. Race replaced piety. There's nothing wrong with the Israelites of the Old Testament except that they continually abandoned God. But in terms of the theology of the time, there's nothing wrong with it. This was God's revelation. This is not the case in our modern day or in this period. All nations other than the Jews were declared unclean animals. Rabbis, not any scriptures, they were the authority. Now this wasn't uttered to the Russians who saw the justification of their lifestyle. That would be revealed slowly in time. Thankfully, the church and crown, working together, destroyed this heresy. And this is also an excellent example of symphony. The famous Russian historian Karamzin writes the following. The Jewish science of the Kabbalah was captivating for the ignorant and curious minds in the 15th century, a time when many of the most learned men were looking anew at all the major mysteries of the human mind. Kabbalists boast that ancient legends came down from Moses. They claimed even to have the books received by Adam from God. This was the main source of Solomon's wisdom. With it, they can know all the secrets of nature, interpret dreams, predict the future, command spirits, and soon rule the world. They reduced the sayings of the Old Testament to clever allegories and nothing more. No wonder that these suggestions produced a dramatic effect in the minds of the weak and cunning Jews. And once having mastered them, assured them that the Messiah has not yet appeared in the world. End quote. And when he says Jews, he means the converts that the Judaizers had made. But in this translation, anyway, it says simply Jews. But we're talking about people like Alexei and others who had been converted. Remember, in Poland and Lithuania at the time, Jews were a privileged caste. They were regarded as free men, subject only to the Polish king and the Grand Duke of Lithuania. They were exempt from military service. They did not have to obey local laws, and were judged only by the Kahal organization. One of the rights that they had was to impose levies on Orthodox churches. The Polish oligarchs, in order to keep the monarch weak, took away the ability of the crown to tax prosperous merchants in the cities, as I mentioned already, thus bringing in Jews that are dependent on their goodwill until the monarch was shut out of this source of revenue. This has been done in more than one place in Eastern Europe. This context, this is the great cause of the Moscow princes, the collecting of all Russian lands into a single state. The weak point of this all-Russian unity was still Novgorod. It had an elite that were very rebellious. But the oligarchs saw Moscow as a threat to their ambition. To a great extent, this experiment into the Kabbalah was just another attempt to justify secession from Moscow and to carve out this separate identity. In fact, the reason that Ivan III, again Ivan the Terrible, invaded the area was because they were planning on becoming a part of the Polish state, even renouncing Orthodox. They were working on some deals. They didn't really care. Oligarchs cared about their property and their privileges. Now, all contemporary sources show that the Judaizers are connected to sodomy. Now, sodomy could mean fornication, adultery, and homosexuality. So it's possible their adherents were initially homosexuals, now had an excuse for their pathology. This is hinted in the condemnation of the fallen Metropolitan Zosima of Novgorod. In the Synod of 1490, Metropolitan himself had become a member of this movement. Now, Saria himself took advantage of the ignorance of the Russian clergy. This is unfortunately something even St. Gennadius complained about. They were easy targets. But to go to these Jewish invaders and call them adherents of Western rationalism, as your typical historian will say, making six figures in the university is laughable. The way that I was taught in grad school, the way that I read until I learned Russian, was that these were rationalists that rejected the liturgy and the sacraments and icon and priestly corruption. That's what the Judaizers were. And so Moscow was threatened by it. That's the ridiculous narrative that I was taught. If you can't read Russian, you don't know the truth of the matter. But it is true to say that they were nominalists and materialists. The problem was, in Russian especially, there really wasn't much of a language to communicate views like that. Often I've heard very good Russian scholars say that they stress the Old Testament over the New Testament, as if these Jews cared about the Old Testament. No, I mean, they took slogans from Solomon and they mixed it with magic and alchemy. This is why St. Gennadius of Novgorod printed the first full Bible in Slavonic. There had always been books that were used for the liturgy. So you had the whole New Testament and Old Testament in pieces. Sometimes in a unified, between two covers, but it was not unified and was not approved. This is what St. Gennadius had to do to make certain that they couldn't manipulate this anymore. You know, the Orthodox Bible is very difficult. It promises little but pain in this life. The promises of the revolutionaries, though, is power. It does require manipulation, and it appears the subrational. The Orthodox truth has to be guarded strictly because it's hard to accept. One of the anathemas read during the Sunday of Orthodoxy goes like this. Priest Alexander and Dionysius, Ivan the Wolf Kadizin, Phignos, Monk Joseph Okunkin, all the followers of the Judaizer movement, as well as their sympathizers and teachers, all you that despise the church through this heresy, all you who have driven the abominable and damned Jew, many from the faith and from the safety of the church, anathema. Now, whether the hipster docs, boomer docs, OCA wants to deal with it or not, this is part, and this was used in the universal church. This is what a Jew meant in the Russian world. It did not refer to the Karaites. It didn't refer to the cobbler across the street. It referred to a movement like this. So believing in Jewish supremacy or Zionism or Judeo-Christianity in any way whatsoever is condemned openly by this synod. There is no such thing as Judeo-Christianity. That's an abomination. It's sick. It doesn't exist. It's like a Roman Catholic member of the Orange Order. Now, you can't say that this is from a local synod, and therefore I don't have to listen to it. It could be Zionists. No, well, most of the anathemas read on the Sunday of Orthodoxy are from local councils. I mean, in 2005, the Patriarch Alexei II awarded Rabbi Schneider the Order of St. Daniel of Moscow. Can you imagine? Since, according to the Talmud, this medal would be a cursed object, must have been immediately destroyed by the rabbi, of course. But this kind of currying favor places him under the anathema. Let's trickle Nicky and the Bogomils, and these are not dissimilar. They took power by seducing the upper classes, using sex and the promises of power. You don't have to be an ascetic anymore. You can indulge your appetites. We'll make sure you get all the money you need, and we can justify this for you. And the real attraction that they can now pose as progressive versus their ignorant country bumpkins, co-nationals. It was an effective combination of forces that typified all revolutionary groups to this very day. So we have a few things going on. There is no doubt that the Jews saw themselves as a revolutionary force in Europe. We know that they invaded Russia through Novgorod for the purpose of destroying the church. You know that they used sexual revolution and sexual indulgence as part of their agenda. We know that they were connected to alchemy and the various ways that we're going to create Adam Kadmon, the new man of the end time. What I personally think is the Antichrist. Judaizers and Old Russia show that there was a serious attempt to take Russia for the Jewish and Kabbalistic idea that became our modern world. It was considered by Ivan III an invasion. They're able to use carnal sins as a lever of power. The fact that there was a connection with the Hanseatic League and the Merchant Republic shows you, of course, it's connected with money. The reaction against this movement defined Russian church politics for centuries to come and gives us a glimpse into the revolutionary mind in all of Europe to this very day. All revolutionary and radical movement were Jewish in Europe from this point on. So it really behooves the historian to take this blatantly Judaic movement very seriously. But at the time, it gave Moscow a clear notion that Novgorod needed to be firmly bound to Moscow or will become a source of invasion in the future. Finally, it showed the capitalists of the West that Russia was its main enemy. Nothing has changed. We talk about the Judaizer movement of old Russia because nothing has changed. They saw Russia as Christendom. They needed to destroy it. This is what they did. And the only thing worse than that is how historians treat it. The mental gymnastics that they go through to reword everything. Try to, figure out how to make this seem harmless. Turns these guys into a joke. I have never come across a serious work on the Judaizers in English, and I read everything. Usually it's glossed over in the big survey histories, of which there are hundreds. But for a historian making six figures and having tenure at a big university to say that this movement was against church corruption, not that this was about, and they were rationalists, is absolutely criminal. They need to be removed from their positions of teaching. They shouldn't be there if they're this incompetent. But I'm here to tell you that competence has never been, and unfortunately will never be, connected to being hired or promoted in academia. Ability or knowledge that you would think would be the main thing in the academic world can in fact be nothing but a problem. Knowledge is dangerous. What a university wants the professors to do is go into the classroom and to spout the official line and be disconnected to the students and to be policemen looking for any sign of political incorrectness. Now, I've taught all over the country, and I just had an orientation not too long ago at a local school here near Pittsburgh. And it was 8 hours long, 4 hours was dedicated to how do we police students and who do we report students to for showing any change in behavior, political, any kind of political opinion that may lead to violence. We had to report every, and I never did this, of course, we had to report every little thing to the university. This is what a professor is today. When I was hired at Penn State, unfortunately the Mount Alto campus is in such trouble, I couldn't stay there. I was let go with a bunch of other professors not too long ago. About two-thirds of the orientation was dedicated to this. Knowledge was never the issue. It's maintaining this kind of absolutely uniform sense of order. The university campus is the regime's utopia. It's a completely authoritarian, totalitarian body dedicated to total indulgence and political correctness. And if you go awry, they will send you to re-education. And it's actually called re-education in certain places. I know that because I've been sent there. Where do you send your kids to school? Well, that's for another time. Anyway, I'm at my hour. I do appreciate financial assistance, as I always do. Please donate to me from my button, my website also, rushjournal.org. And I thank you. I thank my friends. And I also thank my enemies. You might be stupid, but you do keep me on my toes. I'll talk to you next time. Bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.